Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Hey, mister, that's a mighty big dog you got there.
Help me, Jesus! Help me, Jewish God! Help me, Allah! Ah! Help me, Tom Cruise!
It's Linderman Unleashed on Natural News Radio.
You tell him I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear?
All opinions and views expressed on Linderman Unleashed are strictly those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Natural News Radio. Warning, this program might cause you to think for yourself. Listener discretion is advised. And now, here's your host, Kurt Linderman.
Well, that's right, you are listening to Linderman Unleashed. I'm your host, Kurt Linderman Sr., bringing you the bare-knuckled right hook of truth to any that would try to put the chokehold on your liberty and health freedom. We've got a very, very special guest today. Last week, I talked about the Clinical Epigenetics Biomed Central Study, the macroepigenetic approach to identify factors responsible for the autism epidemic in the United States. And I have the chief author here, Renee Default, to talk about the study. She has such a huge resume, such a huge bio. I'm going to let Renee kind of just introduce herself. Renee, welcome to Linderman Unleashed.
Thank you, Kurt. I appreciate your invitation to speak and to help educate the consumers out there. Thank you.
I'll tell you what, it's a very impressive paper. I am very interested in the entire high fructose corn syrup debate, and this paper made so much sense to me. when I started talking about it on one of last week's programs, I just felt the need to get you on the program to really talk about it, because I just don't think that I could do it justice. So many of my listeners on Linderman Unleashed are very familiar with the autism epidemic. I would say many of them have children that are suffering from an autism spectrum diagnosis. I myself am a parent of a child on the spectrum, so I do delve into that subject quite extensively on this program. So first off, introduce yourself to the audience as far as what gives you these credentials to talk about this macro epigenetic approach to the high fructose corn syrup debate with autism.
Okay, well, I guess my background is primarily toxicology. I spent 20 years in the uniformed services, and my initial background starting out was in industrial hygiene, which is the study of how chemicals are used in industry, and also any exposures that a worker might have in the workplace when dealing with different hazards in the workplace, whether it be noise or the use of chemicals or radiation. So, you know, there's biological, chemical, and physical agents that can cause harm to your body. And my role for much of my career was to identify those potential hazards in the workplace and then, provide for protective measures for the workers. So that's my background. I also did a lot of medical research, laboratory decommissioning, and cleanup, environmental cleanup work. I got interested in mercury and where it is in our environment. I kept finding it in plumbing systems, in medical research laboratories, as I was doing the cleanup work. And so we wondered why, how it is that we were finding all this mercury, and it was pretty much every laboratory. And so one thing led to another, and I started chasing this mercury to find out where it was coming from. And I found out that, some of it was coming from chemicals that were being flushed down drains for many years prior to the regulations that we now have for proper hazardous waste disposal. So, that got me interested in the chloralkali industry because that's the foundation. The chlorine industry is the foundation industry upon which all other chemicals are derived. Synthetic chemicals. So, mercury cell chloralkali plants produce chlorine, sodium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide, and hydrogen chloride. So these chemicals are then used to make other chemicals like sodium benzoate and food colors and so forth. So anyway, one thing led to another, and as I was investigating this mercury, I found out that one of the biggest users of mercury cell chloralkali chemicals was the high fructose corn syrup industry. This was being touted on one of the chemical companies' web pages. And, of course, I have all of this. I have saved everything. I've been waiting around for a congressional inquiry so I can produce all this information. But anyway, the bottom line is, for many years, the mercury cell caustic soda was the chemical of choice for high fructose corn syrup manufacturing because, according to interviews with a high fructose corn syrup plant manager, that was the preferred type of caustic soda because it enhanced the product shelf life. So the product, once it was made, would stay on the shelf longer because there wouldn't be any bacterial growth or mold or anything else. So anyway, that sort of got me on the path of chasing the mercury in the high fructose corn syrup. And I'm just, I've been on it ever since, trying to understand how consumption of fructose with a little mercury in it, maybe, or even food colors with a little mercury in them, because by law, a certain amount of mercury is allowed in some of the chemicals in the food supply, because we know that there's mercury residue from using these mercury cell chloralkali chemicals. So I've just been, chasing it down and looking at how much we eat, what we eat, and then how it could possibly affect our immune system. And I got interested in the brain functioning in Alzheimer's initially, and had participated with some early research on the human olfactory bulb and how, mercury might cause problems from exposure to mercury amalgam. And that was probably the earliest bit of research on regarding humans. So then from there, it just went to autism. And so that's the deal. I've been reading the literature and and putting the, put together this model to explain how the food supplies and what we're eating might impact our body metabolism and in turn our gene function. And along with what we know about environmental exposures across populations. So we call this process of examining food supplies and their impact on body metabolism and gene function, along with what we know about environmental exposures in any geographic region, as macroepigenetics. So we're taking a big picture look and trying to tie these pieces together. So that's pretty much it.
Well, Renee, thank you for that, and I really appreciate that explanation. Now, I think I may have had quite a feeble attempt at trying to explain to my audience last week the macroepigenetic approach, as opposed to what so many of us that do our research in the autism community see as a, not an epigenetic approach, but more of an epidemiological approach. Could you explain what makes this study, looking at it on an epigenetic level, different from a lot of the studies that are done in the autism research community, you know, using an epidemiological approach?
Well, with epidemiology, you're really trying to control variables, because there are many reasons why a disease process starts. And so with epidemiology, you're trying to control different potential variables that could be contributing to the development of the disease. And so you might look at one or two or even more. There, you can look at lots of different variables, and then you run statistical analysis to see whether or not those variables have a high enough connection, if you will, or association to actually causing the disease. You can't really find the cause of a disease that way. You can just find association. So that epidemiology is just a way of doing research, but it doesn't really, it's starting to incorporate the food we eat and diet surveys. This is pretty new, probably the last 10 years or maybe even less, that where they're starting to look at what we eat in addition to, you know, the normal variables like blood pressure or glucose levels or, you know, whatever it is they're looking at. The diet, you know, for the longest time, they weren't looking at what we ate. And they might look at what people are being exposed to in the environment by, as could be identified in their biomarkers, like, for example, if you're being exposed to organophosphates, you know, there's several studies that look at farm workers and the pesticide exposure, and they can look at the urine to see, you know, whether or not they're being exposed. So, or in epidemiology, you could look at drinking water and see what potential exposures one might have to toxic substances in the drinking water supply. Perhaps you would live in an area where there would be high arsenic levels, and then you could test a person who's been drinking that water's urine to see how much arsenic they might be getting. So, you know, it's sort of like, it's not really looking at a broad angle view with, you know, connecting all the pieces. What are we eating? Where do we live? What are the potential environmental exposures we might have in our environment, because it varies across the geographic population.
Right.
So we try to look at, and that's another thing with epidemiology. I mean, if you're studying a group of Japanese, then that study's only good for that group, because that, you know, they're studying people living in Japan and in that geographic area with that diet. So, you know, you have to take epidemiological studies with a grain of salt and look at where the study was done. And, you know, like even with autism, you have lots of studies out there that are being done on autism across the world that you've got to look at. You know, that study would just be, the data would be good for those people in that area, as opposed to, you know, if you live somewhere else. Just to give you an idea of blood mercury levels, because I've been focusing on a new project right now on mercury and its association with the development of insulin resistance. Okay, well, in Germany, for example, the mean blood mercury levels of that general population, even when they consume fish, is far less than our, in the United States, our mean mercury levels. And so that means there's something in our diet that is interfering with mercury metabolism compared to Germany. Because, and I know what that is. You probably know what I'm thinking. And because the Germans don't consume high fructose corn syrup, and high fructose corn syrup consumption interferes, probably, we have to prove it yet, but likely interferes with heavy metal metabolism. So, you know, you really have to look at the big picture. What are folks eating, and how is it that what they're eating is contributing to their metabolism?
Well, I'll tell you what. Renee, we're gonna take a quick commercial break because I'm just going to do it a couple of minutes early because I really have a question that I know is going to take a little bit of time. So we will be right back on Linderman Unleashed with our special guest, Renee DeFault.
Hey, folks, it's Kurt Linderman, host of Linderman Unleashed on naturalnewsradio.com. Are you a parent who wants to educate your children on vaccine issues so that they are equipped with the truth when faced with peer and social pressures from the pro-vaccine crowd? Are they prepared to deal with the pro-vaccine messages from the media found in cartoons, schools, and commercials? Are you a professional in need of a quick reference for your patients regarding vaccine ingredients, side effects, and exemptions? If so, no vaccine Vaccines for Me is for you. No Vaccines for Me is the first interactive family book written as a resource for like-minded parents and professionals who choose not to vaccinate. No Vaccines for Me is written in an easy-to-read format with great illustrations. No Vaccines for Me facilitates discussion and educates readers of all ages, especially children. No Vaccines for Me books and t-shirts can be ordered at NoVaccinesForMe.com. NoVaccinesForMe.com. Educate yourself. Educate your children. NoVaccinesForMe.com.
Are you frustrated with surging grocery prices and the very real possibility of empty grocery store shelves? If the food transportation system were disrupted, how long could you and your family live on the food in your home pantry? Being prepared for what life might throw your way provides a tremendous peace of mind. A home food store is the perfect insurance against the unknown and the unforeseen. It often seems like a daunting task to start, store, and use your food storage. Beth Dunsing, an independent consultant with Shelf Reliance, offers you an easy and healthy solution. Thrive Foods. Thrive Foods are healthy, delicious, GMO-free foods with no additives, no preservatives, and a long 20 to 30 year shelf life without refrigeration. Foods so delicious, you will want to use them every day. Beth will help you use the free online planning tools to customize a food storage plan that fits your family, your budget, and your space. Guarantee that you will never look into the eyes of a hungry loved one and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Food is key to your family's survival. To receive a personal password to guarantee you receive the low Linderman Unleashed pricing, send an email to me at LindermanUnleashed@hotmail.com. Get started today.
And we are back, Linderman Unleashed, Rabid Talk Radio, naturalnewsradio.com, with our special guest, Renee DeFault. Her recent paper written, Biomed Central, actually on Biomed Central, I was speaking with Renee yesterday, and she said it's actually the most viewed paper on the entire list. I'll tell you what, Renee, why don't we go ahead and talk about that, the Biomed Central open access publisher. This is the most viewed paper in how many different publications?
Well, Biomed Central is one of three major public access medical journal publishers, if you will.
Right.
So this particular group, Biomed Central, they publish 220 different medical journals. So of those 220 journals, hundreds of articles get published every month. And our article is currently the most viewed in the last 30 days. And it hasn't even been 30 days since it's been out. So it's already, you know, it's being widely consumed, if you will, widely read in the world. It's getting a lot of attention, this new macro epigenetic approach to narrow down the factors responsible for disease development. Because you can apply the same approach to other diseases, you know, beyond autism.
Well, absolutely. I honestly believe that, Renee, this is something. I knew the minute that I read this paper that this was something big, that I could really relate to it. Now, this macro epigenetic approach could be related to diabetes, just asthma. It could be related to, you know, used to study any of those things. This particular one, though, this paper that you've written, is regarding autism and its relationship, or what's causing the autism, the possibility being the high fructose corn syrup. Let's get right into that as far as looking at that macro epigenetic approach to what is high fructose corn syrup doing to possibly cause this epidemic that we see of autism.
Well, we're consuming on average high fructose corn syrup per person in the United States. And that just includes high fructose corn syrup, okay? If we were to include all the other corn sweeteners in that product line, because when they're making high fructose corn syrup, they from that same process, they have other sweeteners that come out of it, okay? So if we were going to consider all of those sweeteners, then we would be consuming closer to, 40-something pounds per year of corn sweetener, okay? But we consume this amount of corn sweetener when other populations do not, okay? So that's great. I mean, that's a great variable to be able to parse out, because that fructose is metabolized differently than sucrose to some degree. And what that means is with excessive fructose consumption, which I would probably say we are excessively consuming fructose in the United States, pretty much the public health sector probably agrees on that. I mean, you see all these studies done on the children and obesity and consuming soda and all this. So let's just assume that we are excessively consuming this substance. Well, there's a really top endocrinologist out there named Rob Lustig, and he is determined, because he works with obese children, that fructose is not the same as sucrose in the way that your liver handles it. And so what happens is you get this excessive fructose that your cells cannot use. Every cell can use glucose. You can only have so much fructose before your liver starts saying, hey, overload. So you develop, it's converted to fat, if you will. And so that fat, then we get fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and, all kinds of problems. So despite what the sugar, what the corn refiners are saying, there's plenty of evidence now to show that fructose does not behave the same way in the body. It's not used by the cells the same as glucose or sucrose even. So by definition, high fructose corn syrup is more fructose than glucose. So that's the problem right there in a nutshell.
But yet, Renee, on the TV commercials from the Corn Growers Association, they've got the little farmer's wife out there doing the picnic on the front on the front lawn as grandpa's carrying the kids over, and they say, I've done my research, and high fructose corn syrup is recognized in the body the same as sugar. How the hell do they get away with that?
Well, I don't know. They're trying to sell their product. But if anybody does their research, I mean, look at what Rob Lustig, he's a renowned pediatric endocrinologist, and look at what people are writing, the professionals who spend their lives researching dynamics of fructose metabolism. That's what you need to look at, not what somebody on TV is telling you.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to sell a product, and high fructose corn syrup is generally recognized as safe by the FDA, and it has been for many years. So, they don't have to do any toxicity testing or whatever. In fact, when they apply for status as a grass substance for fructose, back then, and I think it's still the same way today, it was the burden. The burden was on the industry to show that the substance was not non-toxic. So, you have the industry basically saying, well, we've done our studies and it's non-toxic. And the FDA says, okay, so here we go. Well, let's do grass. We generally recognize that as safe because you say so. So
wow.
That's sort of the way it is. But bottom line is, fructose does behave differently in your body than sucrose, and by definition, it's different, and that is just the way it is. So in our bodies, there's been a couple human studies that show what high fructose corn syrup does to humans, and what we know is that it leads to mineral imbalances, and it disrupts the homeostasis of the body's metabolism, and so you end up with zinc losses. Copper gain, and you end up with calcium loss if you are also low in magnesium in your diet, dietary magnesium as well, which most Americans are actually, according to USDA, then you can have significant calcium loss occurring from consumption of high fructose corn syrup. So, these are some zinc and calcium are key elements required to build important proteins and enzymes in your body to make it work right. And without these key elements, you start accumulating heavy metals, even in normal people. And you would also be less able to excrete organophosphate, pesticide, you know. So it is what it is. There's the human studies to back it up, and the evidence is there. So, you know, I don't know what, we haven't heard anything contrary to that.
So
it is what it is.
We've got a government that's allowing, you know, with the FDA and everything, allowing this high fructose corn syrup to be used. The agricultural industry, the USDA, you've got Monsanto and all of these big corporations that, contrary to what some people might believe, own the United States government as far as lobbying efforts and what have you go. So you're allowing this high fructose corn syrup to be generally recognized as safe, and people are just being inundated in their Western diet with this stuff. We're taking this stuff. It's really creating a perfect storm with the government backing it, industry saying it's perfectly fine, food industry just putting it into everything. You know, we're ingesting massive quantities of it, and it's creating not only the fact that a lot of this has the mercury, the heavy metals in it, but it's also creating that perfect storm with, as we're taking it in, we're unable to get rid of the stuff that it's putting in us, correct? With trying to detoxify the heavy metals, it's already causing us not to be able to do that.
Well, we need more studies to show this is occurring, but that appears to be occurring in autistic children,
right,
according to what we put together and all the evidence that we found. But, you know, we'd have to do a lot more studies to see how consumption of fructose contributes to other disease conditions. But bottom line is, we're all born with a set of genes, and we can turn them on and off by what we eat and what we're exposed to, and that's a fact. So that's why we're seeing some children with autism have vast improvements on a gluten-free diet. I mean, you know, if they're going gluten-free, then they're not going to have that organophosphate exposure that their bodies can't handle, because there's this gene variation that's been found in children with autism in North America, as opposed to Italy, for example. And that gene variation means that some children with autism have difficulty metabolizing organophosphate pesticides, which are most commonly found in wheat and corn. So, you know, obviously, then if you take them off a gluten diet, then they're going to have some improvement. And the same, you know, a lot of children with autism do a lot better with taking them off of food colors. And, you know, food colors there's certain residues that are allowed at certain amounts because of the way that some of these food colors are made, you know, with the chemicals. So we know that there's a certain allowable amount of mercury or even arsenic in a couple of them. So depending on how they're made, you know, so you take these kids, if the kids are already having some genetic predisposition to not being able to metabolize heavy metals, then when you take them off of food colors, well, they do, you know, they can do a lot better because they're not getting that heavy metal load. So we know there's been enough studies that have been published on children with autism that they do get, you know, they have some healthier outcomes by changing the diet. So this is what the evidence says. And, you know, I think, you know, with the methyl shot, B12 shots that often doctors are now doing to try to help these children, you know, there's also foods that you can consume in quantities large enough to do the same thing as the methyl B12 shot. So you've got to look at the food you've eaten, what's available, take them off of all the conventional grains, you know, conventionally grown grains, and all the food colors, all the sodium chemicals, and clean them up, clean their bodies up, you know, give them lots of spinach, you know, and broccoli, and, you know, some of these fish oil, and, you know, they're mercury-free, of course, and, you know, there's enough evidence out there and studies that are done that show what can help these children improve. And the sooner the dietary interventions are done, the earlier the age, then the better for the child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you what, we're going to take another quick commercial break, because I've got some questions for Renee that I just want to not have any more commercial breaks for her to answer. So we will be right back. You're listening to Linderman Unleashed, naturalnewsradio.com.
Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas,
plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash, because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created Webseed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
And we're back to Linderman Unleashed. I'm your host, Kurt Linderman Sr. We have a special guest on the phone today, Renee Dufault, author of Macro Epigenetic Approach to Identify Factors Responsible for the Autism Epidemic in the United States. Renee, welcome back to the program. I'll tell you what, I guess one of the main questions that I have for you is, in, like you were saying at the beginning of the program, this, oh, say the last decade or so, the epigenetic approach to identifying disease factors and causation has slowly gained momentum. But I truly believe, and I'd like your personal opinion on this, I truly believe that there is a certain large segment of the scientific community that really doesn't want to see this macroepigenetic approach take hold, because they've hoarded themselves out to industry so bad, and this epigenetic approach can really prove things that they've been trying to disprove on the epidemiological studies. Is that something that you're seeing?
Well, I think that corporations, and we're talking industry, so corporations. Corporations are in our universities now. You see many universities that have entire wings built because somebody donated money. And, pharmaceutical companies, if they want to do the clinical trials on a new drug, then they farm that work out to universities. So the bottom line is certainly in the universities there is a relationship between corporate America and top universities. I would have to say that's probably true. And it is what it is. And so I think that what we need to do in order to turn this thing around is community-based participatory research. So what we need to do is we need to pour funding together to support research where there is no profit involved. I mean, there is research being done in autism, but it's primarily on treatment. treatment, and that's good. We need treatment, but let's do prevention too. And in fact, since we already know what treatments actually do work, a combination of ABA and dietary, it's the best. Then let's get kids enrolled in studies where you do the interventions early on, and you do a combination of the combination approach, and show how dietary changes improve things. And when you need pregnant women or women who want to get pregnant, and I don't know how anybody could be involved in research where you knowingly allow pregnant women and say, yeah, it's okay to eat high fructose corn syrup. I mean, wow, I'm not going there. That is not a place I want to go. But bottom line is, I think, to do community-based participatory research where the families are involved and the and outside, I don't know, maybe you can find people at universities who are willing to do community-based participatory research. It's becoming a hot new area. And I do think that the communities have to start initiating their own research, especially when we're looking at geography. And the bottom line is where you live and what you're being exposed to is going to impact the way that you're and what you eat. All of these factors is going to impact whether or not you have end up with autism in your family. So I would say that's probably the answer, is to have families become more involved in the research at the community level. And then that means you partner with whoever's willing to do that kind of research. And then I don't know what to say about. I think the government. The government is not bad. I mean, you have people working in the government who are just like you and me, and truly advocates for public health. And so, there are many people in the government who are in that line of thinking, and they're not thinking about profits or all of that. They want to do disease prevention and preventive medicine. There are people like that, and they are willing to support this type of community-based participatory research I'm talking about. So I think the biggest partner for the future is to find those people in government willing to support that type of research and to partner with organizations who are willing to, at the community level, willing to do it. And that's just how it is. I don't know what to say about the current status of research, but I'll tell you what, if the research isn't done here, it'll be done elsewhere, because there's other countries who will do the research. So even if American researchers don't want to do it, it'll get done. Now, this day and age, with the internet and public access and information being available, many scientists want to share what they know. They don't want to hoard it and try to patent it, So I think the research will get done. There will be changes, because they must be made, and it'll be like DDT, DDT is no longer legal in the U.S., but the chemical companies still make it and sell it to other places.
Right.
So it'll probably be the same thing, At some point, things are going to change, and it'll just have to, because we've got the diabetes epidemic and autism and, cardiovascular disease and all of the things that are, our healthcare system is definitely under stress, and until we start really looking at prevention seriously, and there's enough evidence to show what's going on. It's just somebody has to be courageous enough to do the right thing.
Right, and that's definitely the challenge. Now, when we were talking yesterday, it really blew my mind to find out, I had read some research a couple of years ago about the, how they made high fructose corn syrup, and some of the antiquated U.S. plants actually made it with the mercury cell deals that, you and I will talk about here. But it really blew my mind when you were talking about how so much, not just the high fructose corn syrup, but so much of what is made in America and abroad, for that matter, that's being shipped into America, is made using that same process, and the amount of mercury that has to be accumulating in us has got to be just astronomical.
Well, we know that mercury is accumulating in us just like fish because there's already been studies by more than one author. It shows that the inorganic mercury in our systems has been increasing over time. I mean, a guy out of UCLA, Dan Lax, did a study that showed, you know, between, I think it was 1999 and 2006, inorganic mercury in blood levels of women of childbearing age had increased from 3% to 30% of women. You know, and that was using the government data, NHANES data. So we know that mercury levels are increasing. That means our bodies are more and more under stress. And so bottom line is this is a given, and he's not the only one to see that and report that data. There's other papers out. So, it is what it is. The big argument is whether or not inorganic mercury is harmful. And, of course, old-school toxicologists were saying that, no, of course it's not. Well, you know, a lot of those rat studies upon which they based their beliefs were done many years ago in the 40s and 50s, and it was even before, and those rats weren't even fed high fructose corn syrup. So, you know, when you're when so much of your diet is on one substance, I mean, let's face it, 95 pounds per year per person wheat in the U.S., close to corn sweeteners, we're looking at close to 45, 46 pounds per year, and then spinach, less than 1 pound a year.
Yeah. Wow.
And strawberries, you know, just minimal, you know, three pounds at that, or 2 pounds. You know, so the fresh fruit and vegetables, we don't eat very much of those things, but we eat all this other stuff, big amounts. So, you got to look at what we eat. And I lost my train of thought there, but...
Well, I think what it is what we're eating, we're just accumulating more of the bad stuff, and we're not eating the stuff that's going to help our bodies run at its optimum level and detoxify and get rid of what little bit of bad stuff we should be eating. You know, there's no doubt about that. Now, one of the things that I talked about when I talked about this study on a previous program, and as I said, I don't think I did it as much justice as I possibly wished I could have, but I wondered, why in the heck is high fructose corn syrup in bread? And then, of course, we talked about that yesterday. Could you explain that one to our audience?
Yeah, because high fructose corn syrup is marketed, and you can find a brochure on the corn refiner's website. They'll probably take it off now that we're saying this. But anyway, I have a copy. You can download it. And it says right in there that high fructose corn syrup enhances product shelf life. And it enhances product stability. Or, you know, I don't know what the exact words are, but it enhances how well the product holds together on that shelf so that it stays a long time, if you will.
And now what causes it to add to that product stability? What in high fructose corn syrup could possibly add to its, you know, less ability to mold, that kind of thing?
Right. We can only speculate. Now, we did our early studies of, we collected samples in 2005 from corn refiners and found mercury in those samples that we collected through chain of custody. FDA investigator went out and collected those samples and found mercury in half of them, or about half of them. And then, the corn refiners said that those were old samples and it didn't. They weren't using mercury-grade chemicals anymore to make their corn syrup. Well, in 2010, a Canadian group working with the Canadian government, I believe, they went and took corn syrup right off the shelves of Canadian stores and found mercury in all of the products. So, and of course, you know, David Belinga did that. He took products off the shelf with high fructose corn syrup for second ingredient and found mercury in those in 2009. So, you know, I don't know what to say except that there seems to be some evidence that that they're still using mercury cell chloralkali product to make the corn syrup, but we don't, it wouldn't matter. It's perfectly legal. you know, this is all legal. They're not doing anything against the law. They're operating within the confines of the law and what's allowable under international and international food regulations. So it's the federal and international food regulations that are allowing all of this. And we're talking about international trade. You know, they want to have products that stay good on the shelf so they can ship them overseas, you know. So that is what it is, and it's a fact of life. So there are pesticides that are used and trace amounts of other things to ensure that the product stays good on the shelf. And so what does that leave for people that, you know, certainly, well, I would suggest going back to the community level of, going to the farmers markets with the local produce, switching to organic and, buying things that you can freeze yourself long term, grow things in the summer and freeze them. And that's what you're going to have to do to avoid these things. I can't imagine the whole world deciding to change the way that they manufacture food. I mean, let's face it, this is a profit-driven capitalistic market that we live in. And it's all over the world, and that is not going to change because people want to make money. So then all you can do as an individual and at the community level is to create a system of food for yourself that you know is safe.
Yeah, and that definitely makes sense, and that's definitely something that we talk about on Linderman Unleashed all the time. Now, the other thing that kind of blew me away when we were talking earlier is we take in, as Americans, a hell of a lot more of this high fructose corn syrup than our European counterparts, for the most part. Now, the thing that really got me was I was under the impression that we were in America the ones that were antiquated and using this mercury cell chlorine chemicals to make the high fructose corn syrup and putting the mercury in it. But from what you were saying to me, that high fructose corn syrup with the mercury cell technology is made in Europe and imported to the U.S. as well. Even though they don't use it, they make it and import it poison us.
No. To my knowledge, I don't know how much high fructose corn syrup is being made in Europe. I don't think probably very much of it at all. I don't think they even make high fructose corn syrup in Europe. I'm pretty sure that they don't, okay? What they do make in Europe is mercury cell chlorine products.
Okay.
So, yeah, mercury cell chloralkali chemicals. And so the largest producer where the most mercury cell chloralkali product is the United Kingdom. So, wow. And they're exporting a great deal of this product to the U.S.
And do they also use a lot of it in Great Britain, the United Kingdom?
Well, I don't know where they, sell it all. But you can look at the International Trade Commission, the U.S. International Trade Commission, and get the information on who, where we're getting mercury, where we're getting chloralkali chemicals. And then to figure out if they're mercury cell chloralkali chemicals, you have to go to the United Nations Environment Program, and they have a spreadsheet that shows where all the mercury cell chlorine plants are in the world. Okay, and then it shows, where they are. And then when you know where they are, then you can look at the import data and see, well, how much of the material coming from that country, you can estimate how much of it will be mercury cell. So we're definitely importing mercury cell chloralkali chemicals.
Well, and I'll tell you what, Renee, I just had an aha moment, if you will, and I'll bet you many of my very educated listeners had a very aha. I have a lot of listeners in the UK as well that listen to this program on a regular basis, and one thing that we're seeing is the reason that I ask the question is if they're consuming these chemicals as well over there is because Great Britain actually has as bad, if not worse, of an autism epidemic as we do here in America, as opposed to other countries in the European Union. So that kind of follows along with everything you're talking about in this study.
Yeah, well, that, you know, we know that autism, we don't know, we can only, it looks like that autism, because of The work that was done in Texas by Ray Palmer, he showed that closer you live to mercury pollution, the more likely you would be to, the higher the autism, okay? So mercury pollution plays a role. It's a factor in autism. So if they have all this mercury cell chloralkali production going on in the UK, well, there's bound to be some pollution because it's, every mercury cell plant that that was closed already in the U.S., and there were 30-something plants to begin with, most of those are either under RCRA, remedial cleanup. They're all of them have contamination. So where they are in their cleanup, I don't know. Some of them are, who knows what's left over, and some of them are still under cleanup orders. So you can bet that there's, back in the day, I mean, this type of technology has been around since the late, early 1900s, even in the late 18-something, I think is when they first figured it out, how to make chlorine from salt, breaking apart the atom and using mercury cells. So we're talking a long time. And hazardous waste regulations and proper waste disposal and all of that did not happen until the 80s. So there were many, many years that went by where things were done in probably the only way they knew how to do them. So there's pollution, no doubt, in the UK around those areas. I would bet on it, mercury pollution. And so that is what it is. So that doesn't surprise me at all either.
Well, and I'll tell you what, as I can attest to with my own personal experience, I know that my son was injected with thimerosal, which is 49.6% mercury, and he was injected with 6 vaccines in one day, and that was when I noticed the rapid, decline. He went from a walking, talking, perfectly fine 25 words at 20 months old to within a day after his vaccines, nothing, damn near dead. He was so sick. And I think that might be, as my wife and I explain it, not a cause, but the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back. Because my wife, I know, was eating and drinking and partaking of all these chemicals, normal Western diet, if you will, the soda pop, the high fructose corn syrup, everything else. And it just, it builds up and adds up, and it just really... And the main reason that I love this paper so much is it just kind of puts so much of this into perspective, that there's so much happening. And when you're talking epigenetics, that's really the key to this, is knowing all of these different factors and how it's working to create this epidemic that we're seeing. And it just makes all the sense in the world. One of the things that I had one heck of a time trying to explain, and actually even trying to grasp myself on this particular paper, is the pawn one activity. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. Okay. So pawn one is a gene, and this gene, when it turns on, it makes an enzyme. I'm going to do this in layman's terms. Okay. It makes an enzyme called paraoxynic. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Now this enzyme is really important for breaking down organophosphate pesticides so that they're not toxic. Okay. So we know that there's a difference in a pon one gene in the Italian population and with and in the American. So in the case of autism, children with autism, there's a pon one gene variation, a variation in the way that gene functions in the children in the U.S. as opposed to the children with autism in Italy. Okay, so something makes this gene variation occur in the U.S. So what we talked about in our paper is the fact that pon one is known to be modulated by fructose. So fructose modulates pon one. We know this because rats fed fructose have lower pon one activity levels. So you can determine whether or not pon one does its job.
Right.
Okay. You can modulate it with fructose. So if we're consuming a high fructose diet, then that's going to affect our POM1 activity. And POM1 is really important. It's an important factor in a lot of things, not just autism, but also in diabetes and heart disease. Yeah, so that's another reason why this paper is getting downloaded a lot, because we're talking about a key factor in a lot of these chronic diseases. So, and organophosphate pesticides are a fact of life. They're in our, you know, it's the major pesticide that's being used, okay? So right. And in order to metabolize and excrete that pesticide, when we get it as residue on our food, we've got to have our POM1 working. So in children with autism, we have this POM1 gene variation in the U.S., and it's likely occurring because of the fructose consumption. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, actually.
If you dig a little deeper, well, what is it about fructose that's making this POM1 gene activity go down or decrease? And that's because POM1 is calcium-dependent. You cannot create, POM1 must have calcium to be able to operate properly. And if consumption of high fructose corn syrup depletes your body of calcium, when you're already not getting enough magnesium, it's even worse. Then this is the problem. Now that might not have anything to do with mercury. You with me?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I understand that might not have anything to do with the mercury aspect of it, but just the fact that this high fructose corn syrup is causing that zinc and calcium depletion or taking that away from our bodies, and then this POM1 activity not being able to modulate makes all the sense in the world. What does POM1 have to do with detoxifying of metals? Does it have anything at all to do in our body with detoxification?
Well, the major role of POM1 is to detoxify organophosphate pesticides,
which have heavy metals, correct?
Not to my knowledge. Oh. I don't. Organophosphate pesticides, as far as I know, I don't think they have metals in them, but no one's ever looked at that. I could certainly look into it, and, I haven't done a literature review on that particular angle. It's possible. I don't know.
So POM1 doesn't have anything to do with detoxifying of, say, mercury, aluminum, cadmium, that kind of thing in the body?
No, but I'll tell you what it does do. POM1 peroxidase is considered an antioxidant, if you will. When your body's under stress, POM1 is an important factor in reducing that stress. Oxidative stress?
Right, and so many of our children suffer from oxidative stress that have autism.
Right. So we don't know very much about POM1 as it relates to metal toxicity. I need to look at that more. But for sure, we need it to help our bodies when they are under oxidative stress. No matter where that oxidative stress comes from, I'm under the impression that POM1 is the key antioxidant function. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. And I tell you what, we've got a very, very educated audience that listens to this program, so it's making sense to most of them as well. Renee, I could do 2 hours with you. There's no doubt in my mind. It's just mind-boggling, and there's so much stuff that I want to talk about. If you don't have time to do it now, I'd love to have you back on soon to continue talking about this issue.
Yeah, anytime, and be sure to have people visit our website, www.foodingredient.info.
We will put that on our Facebook page along with this
awesome.
With this copy, and I will be getting back a hold of you, because I know once I get some feedback on this particular program, there's going to be a number of people that are going to want to hear what you have to say once again. There's so many unanswered questions that there's just not enough time. But thank you so much, Renee, for being on the program. I really do appreciate you taking time out of your morning, being in Hawaii as you are, and doing the interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with parents like yourself. Thank you.
Well, it was sure a pleasure, and we will be talking again soon. You have a good day now.
You too. Aloha.
Aloha. You've been listening to Linderman Unleashed and Renee Default. I'm telling you what, there are so many unanswered questions. There's not enough time. I was kind of hoping to get her to say, yeah, let's do another hour, because I could have switched. I could have put it into two programs. I promise you, this is huge. We will be back on this. This answers so many questions, and that is why there are so many researchers out there that are very hesitant to take a look at epigenetic research, because it's going to answer questions that they might not want the answers to. You have been listening to Linderman Unleashed, naturalnewsradio.com. Do not forget, the gloves are off. Have a good one.